Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the elite media takeaway on the nomination to the Supreme Court of arch-conservative Brett Kavanaugh, despite allegations of perjury and an unprecedented lack of access to his work, would seem to be reflected by CNN, which ran two items on the same day: a poll showing more Americans oppose Kavanaugh's confirmation than support it, and an analysis that took his confirmation as a given. Americans don't want it, but it's happening anyway. Next seems to be corporate media's approach to many things these days. Others take democratic dysfunction less sanguinely. We'll talk with Richard Kim, executive editor of The Nation magazine, about that. Also on the show, in 1994, John Bolton declared, "There is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interest and when we can get others to go along." Bolton is now National Security Advisor under a president who shares his ideas that international bodies only exist to the extent that the U.S. finds them useful. You can call that straight talk, but then you also have to care what impact it has when a country declares its sovereignty to be the only sovereignty that matters on the planet. Bolton's target of the moment is the International Criminal Court. We'll talk about what his most recent threats against the ICC mean with Jamil Dakwar, director of the Human Rights Program at the ACLU. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, the weekly program of FAIR, the Media Watch Group. Media are certainly reporting the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, but there's a case to be made that stories that just get views from various folks about what it would be like with Kavanaugh on the court, but sidestep serious questions about the process that would put him there, are doing less covering than covering up. Media get things wrong all the time, but among the deepest damage they do is invisibilizing possibilities, making it seem that things they don't consider can't happen. It's a sort of implicit passivity that permeates corporate reporting, of which the air of, "oh well, what's next?" fatalism, wafting off of much coverage of Kavanaugh, is just one example. Different premises are behind our next guest's recent piece, headlined, "The Supreme Court is an anti-democratic hot mess, and we should change that." Richard Kim is executive editor of The Nation magazine, where that article appears. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, Richard Kim.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, the piece begins, quote, "The United States Supreme Court is, by design, a profoundly anti-democratic institution. And as Republicans get ready to ram Brett Kavanaugh's nomination through the Senate, it's worth pointing out that it doesn't have to be this way," close quote. That, for me, was a very compelling lead. And I'd just like to ask you to unpack it a little. What, first of all, do you mean by the Supreme Court being anti-democratic by design?
Well, you know, so the Supreme Court, when it was formed by the founders, the Constitution actually doesn't say that there have to be nine justices. It's a little ambiguous if they can serve for life, although it's, you know, generally interpreted that way. But I think the thing to point out here is that the justices are appointed by the President of the United States, and that person, the President of the United States, is chosen by the Electoral College, itself an anti-democratic institution that was hatched to protect the interests of slave states. The nominees are then confirmed by the Senate, which is an anti-democratic institution that vastly exaggerates the power of small states over large states. And then the justices, of course, serve for life. And this is not true in any other democracy in the world. So I really liked how you introduced, you know, our conversation, because I think when we approach the Supreme Court and this battle royale that is happening, we accept the very narrow parameters of how we choose justices today. And it doesn't have to be this way. It's not this way in other countries, other democracies in the world. It's not this way in the United States either. And that's a point I was really trying to make, that there are state Supreme Courts across the country, and in 21 of them, justices are elected by the people. In 14 others, they're selected by a nonpartisan committee. And so there are many ways to do this, and there are many ways to arrive at, you know, a Supreme Court that is going to look at the deep constitutional issues of our society and our law. And the way we have chosen to do it now is, in the grand scheme of things, a very anti-democratic process.
Yeah, and yet so much media conversation seems to stop at, well, they should ask tough questions in the hearings. You know, they should ask some hard questions. And that's the sort of the limit of what might be done. Well, it's not true, of course, that Donald Trump introduced hyper-partisanship or extremism to U.S. politics. But with regard to the Supreme Court, things have shifted in terms of what you call the sort of uncodified norms of this process. I wonder, a little history, can you trace the change here and what's behind that change?
So you have to really go back to the nomination of Judge Bork by Ronald Reagan in 1987. And the verb borking has come about from that nomination. And people on the right use the verb borking to mean defaming a nominee and, you know, just really going after them in unfair ways. I actually think what happened in the Bork nomination was an appropriate exercise of the Senate's constitutional duty to vet candidates. People looked at Bork's record. They saw that it was extreme and way outside the mainstream of American views on civil rights, on abortion, on executive power. You know, that view prevailed, and it led the Senate Judiciary Committee to reject his nomination and the Senate to follow suit. Six Republicans voted against Judge Bork. But from that moment, the right knew that it had to have a different strategy to get candidates through, extreme right candidates through. So, you know, that's really when the Federal Society comes in and they construct a pipeline to select and nominate extreme right opponents. And then they also construct a strategy to get them confirmed. And that is in part to answer almost nothing, you know. So that's when, you know, we say we should have tough questions. And you see this on the issue of abortion. People keep asking, you know, Judge Kavanaugh, does he consider abortion settled law? And Judge Kavanaugh is able to say, I consider it settled law. That reveals nothing to us about whether he thinks Roe v. Wade was correctly decided. So, you know, there are a whole range of views. Abortion is just one of them, where the justices' opinions are really going unexamined.
Well, and in his case, it seems like there's an actual lack of the kind of documentation of previous rulings that we would expect to get. And is that just something that, you know, like a president putting out their tax returns, where it was like, golly, we kind of thought this would always happen.
Right. No, it's unprecedented, actually. When Elaida Kagan went before the court, she also had a very voluminous paper trail. She was in the White House counsel's office. And, you know, we saw everything that was there. When Sotomayor was nominated, her entire judicial record, and including things she had written in college, you know, were vetted by the Judiciary Committee. In the case of Justice Kavanaugh, something like 7% of his documents have been produced for the Judiciary Committee. This is unprecedented level of secrecy and non-transparency from the Republican Party that have really shielded him. And I think, you know, one of the details about this that just drives me crazy, because I can't, you know, really believe that we're in this situation, is that, you know, all of the papers that are there from his tenure in the White House counsel's office, the National Archive has said that it would take through the fall to go through them and to, you know, there are some security concerns. There are like IDs that need to be blacked out. That's a legitimate process, but they said it would take months to do that. And so instead, the George W. Bush Presidential Library hired a private attorney, Bill Burke, who was an underling of Justice Kavanaugh's when he was in the White House counsel's office, and his friend, to privately vet these papers without any accountability to any elected official. And by the way, Bill Burke is also a lawyer who represents Rince Priebus, Steve Bannon, and Don McCann, the White House counsel, in the Mueller investigations. So this whole thing, you know, is just a giant conflict of interest. And what's sort of stunning to me is that all has happened kind of in the background, and people don't seem outraged by it. And the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee are not really making as big a deal of it as I think they should.
Well, in terms of what you ask in the piece, why should any of us accept that an increasingly powerful branch of government is selected in such a manner? And the idea of non-acceptance, there's been some conversation around the reliance in general on legal defenses against Trumpism. There's a piece on Socialist Worker in which Mukund Rathi reminds that The courts, like other branches of government, are political bodies that respond to the presence or absence of class struggle and social movements. And I wonder about that piece of it, because there's no lack of frustration. And yet, you know, write your senator and ask them to ask tough questions is just not enough for people. What else is there? What's the space for social action here?
I really think if the process itself is constructed to be so anti-democratic, we need to look at that. But then, you know, in the last 20 years, the right has really endeavored to make it even more anti-democratic, even less transparent, even less accountable to the Constitution and the people. So given that that's happened, given that there was not a confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland, who was Barack Obama's appointee to the Supreme Court, I think everything is on the table. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have 9 members. Why not 11? Why not 13? Roosevelt famously tried this with the court packing scheme, which I will note the nation referred to as a court reform plan, not a court packing scheme. But there are also very many good solutions that come from legal scholars. You could have term limits, and many people have agreed that 18 years is a good number to serve on the court. It ensures some stability, but it also ensures a regular turnover so that each time we have an opening, it doesn't get slotted into this sort of battle royale that's going to shape, you know, American law for a generation. There is a greater role that you can give to impartial legal committees, and this is something that happens in Canada and Japan and other countries where their version of the Bar Association really looks at and puts forward a slate of justices, and then the chief executive picks one. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways we can do this. And you know, part of why I wrote my piece was to really widen the aperture of what is possible.
Absolutely. And I would just add that for media to use that wider aperture would make these things seem possible to people.
Yeah, I agree.
We've been speaking with Richard Kim, executive editor of The Nation magazine. You can find his article, "The Supreme Court is an Anti-Democratic Hot Mess, and We Should Change That," on thenation.com. Richard Kim, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
John Bolton, currently Trump's national security advisor, savors violent imagery. The International Criminal Court, Bolton wrote last year, referring to the international body founded in 1998 to prosecute war crimes, should be strangled in its cradle. This week, in a speech at the Federalist Society broadcast by C-SPAN, Bolton declared the ICC the founders' worst nightmare come to life and dead to us. An outright dangerous entity from whom the U.S. will use any means necessary to protect its citizens. Yes, this is bombast. Typical, the U.S. makes its own rules. If you aren't for us, you're a Guinness. Diplomacy is for suckers. Chest thumping. Reuters called it taking a tough stance. The New York Times chose unyielding. But what should those interested in peace and justice think? And what do others around the world think when the U.S. declares itself officially unaccountable when it comes to the worst kinds of crimes? We're joined now by Jamil Dakwar, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Human Rights Program and an adjunct lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He joins us by phone from here in New York City. Welcome to Counterspin, Jamil Dakwar.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Washington Post, for its part, took issue editorially with Bolton's threatening remarks because the ICC is too unimportant to bother with. It's just a personal bugaboo in their world, in their words, which sounds kind of like another way of making his point. So what, first of all, is the role of the ICC in the world? How is it meant to function?
The ICC, which was founded, as you said, in 98 by a treaty that was negotiated, the United States was part of the negotiations, made some changes, actually, and some amendments that were introduced in order to accommodate, so to speak, the United States. And the court started to function and was running up to speed and running in July of 2002. It has now about 123 countries that ratified this treaty that called the Rome Statute. The United States initially signed the treaty during the Clinton administration. Then the Bush administration in the early 2000 and shortly after 9/11 decided or announced to the world that they are not interested in ratifying the treaty and just left it there. The court is really one of the most important judicial bodies that is in charge of prosecuting or investigating and prosecuting gross violations of international law, particularly war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Most recently, the member states that ratified the statute, their own statute, this treaty, added the crime of aggression to it, but it has a little bit of a different jurisdiction for that crime, and we can talk more about that. But the most important thing that this court is doing really is to ensure that there's accountability and to fight impunity for these really very, very serious crimes under international law. And it works as a court of last resort, meaning it's not something that you go the first thing that after terrible crimes as war crimes happen, but they really try to wait and see what are the governments that are party to an armed conflict in most of the situations that they investigate, but they do investigate other situations that are not an armed conflict, and they ensure that those crimes are fully investigated, that they are credible investigations, that the countries are willing and able to hold perpetrators accountable. And if that is the case, they just don't do anything. They monitor from distance. But when governments fail to take action and they show that they're not genuinely really engaging in investigating war crimes and other serious crimes, they step in. And this is really why they are called a court of last resort. Often people think that, this is the first thing that they do. They're going to investigate anyone who has committed war crimes. In fact, they don't have the capacity, even if they wanted to, even if they had the jurisdiction to investigate war crimes all over the world, they don't have that capacity, and they are really built as a way to ensure that no impunity prevails, that there's some sort of accountability for victims.
Well, it seems very important to say they are not kind of proactively going around the world deciding that crimes have been committed. It's when countries fail to do their own investigation that then the ICC sees fit to step in. Well, John Bolton, of course, would not miss any chance to say international law is not the boss of us, you know. But the timing of this particular speech seems to be meaningful, isn't it, in terms of what the ICC is doing at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, it's the timing when the U.S. under the Trump administration is going on a kind of unprecedented attack on international bodies, particularly the ones that have consistently resisted United States hegemony and United States diktat in terms of ensuring that there will be respect for human rights, ensuring that there will be accountability, ensuring that there will not be just the United States interests that are really protected out there, but it really consisted with international law and consisted with particularly UN Charter of ensuring peace, security, and protection of individual human rights. So there is a general attack on international bodies that this and Trump administration have shown a determination, withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, as we've seen last June, where the U.S. also has been pulling out of negotiations leading up to the Global Migration Pact, which was really an important international pact that would address the root causes of migration and protection of migrants. And there are other examples of how the United States has really shown disrespect and disregard to international law and accountability. And here, the case is even more troubling because the United States is sending a message to the ICC that we are going to boycott you. We will not cooperate with you. We will sever all cooperation, the very limited ones that was developed over the years, even though the United States is not a party to the court. The Trump administration is telling the court that if you decide to move forward with the full investigation into war crimes committed by U.S. forces in Afghanistan, we will then take punitive measures against your staff, against the judges, against prosecutors. We will freeze their assets if they have any assets in the United States. We will ban their travel into the United States. Really very dangerous threats that were made by John Bolton. And why is all that? Is literally an attempt to intimidate judges and prosecutors who basically were telling the United States over the last several years, you have an obligation under your own laws and under treaties that you ratified, including the Geneva Conventions, as well as the Torture Convention, to investigate and fully investigate and independently investigate and prosecute those who committed acts of torture. And the United States had been very, very well documented reports by the last one that was very known maybe to your listeners is the Senate torture report that was released by the Senate Intelligence Committee in December of 2014, which documented the secret detention and torture of about 119 individuals in CIA secret prisons. Some of these prisons were located in Afghanistan, starting in 2002 and onward. Then the CIA created additional prisons in countries like Lithuania, Poland, and Romania, and they transferred individuals who were held by the CIA to these secret locations and tortured them. So the ICC essentially was telling the United States, you have an obligation to investigate. They have not made that announcement because the United States is a party, but because Afghanistan is a member of the court. Mm-hmm. And that is really important for your listeners to understand. Although the United States is not a member of this treaty, did not ratify it, it acted on Afghan soil. It had troops in Afghanistan that were operating, and they committed war crimes and crimes against humanity that have consequences under Afghanistan treaty obligations. And because Afghanistan is party to the court since May of 2003, the ICC has jurisdiction to investigate and to potentially prosecute individuals who will be found to have had a responsibility to commit acts of torture. So this is why we are now in a position where John Bolton is trying to send an intimidating message to the prosecutors and judges not to take the case, the full investigation against the United States, even though this investigation, by the way, is not against, only against the United States officials or members of the armed services or the CIA agents. It involves all parties to the conflict in Afghanistan. It includes the Taliban. It includes Afghan forces. It includes other allied forces like the UK and others who operated in Afghanistan and may have committed war crimes. The torture in Afghanistan by U.S. forces was not just a few bad apples, was not just, you know, few members of the military or the CIA who went rogue and they committed acts of violence and torture against detainees. The acts that were committed there were part of a policy of the United States. One program was under the Secretary of Defense at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, that had authorized the use of torture. And then the second one was under the CIA, where it operated separately from the military and had its own and even worse program that resulted in the use of torture, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment that are a violation of the Geneva Conventions, violations of the also of the ICC, the Rome Statute, because Afghanistan was a party. So even though the United States has never really taken a full responsibility over serious crimes in Afghanistan, that doesn't mean that the crimes were not committed. The United States says, and that's something that Bolton mentioned in his speech, that the United States has a robust judicial system and independent investigative bodies, and if we make mistakes, if we may correct them. And yet, the record, the facts show that we actually did not make any corrections with regard to the CIA program. We have not seen a full investigation. The one that was opened during the Obama administration was very limited scope. It did not look at the whole program. It did not have, to our understanding, a full access to all the information that was collected by the Senate Intelligence Committee. It did not have the authority, and as an independent counsel would have, to go after the fact and to establish fact. And it certainly excluded certain crimes because they tried to establish a certain kind of a protection to certain members of the CIA by saying, if you followed in good faith legal advice that was given to you and you committed acts of torture, you may not be held liable. You may not be held responsible. And so that is part of what the problem was in the investigation. So we see that that the United States failed to investigate its own forces in Afghanistan, including the CIA. As you said, that's why the ICC is stepping in. It is stepping in because they see that these wrongs and these crimes, if they're not investigated and prosecuted, most likely this will happen again in the next armed conflict the United States will be involved in. The other thing that Bolton was trying to say is that the ICC will be able to prosecute, investigate acts of aggression, and he's just using fear-mongering, really. This is an incorrect information. The crime of aggression that was added to the ICC jurisdiction is only applicable to those members of the court. So if you are not a member of the court or your officials are not member of the court, they will not be going after you, will not be going after your officials or members of your armed services. And even for those members of the court, they have to accept the jurisdiction over the crime of aggression. So Bolton not only attacked, threatened, and intimidated, and in order to intimidate the court, he used fear-mongering and he used misinformation in order to show as if that he has a case to be made against the ICC, while we know that the purpose of his speech is to destroy the court, is to really undermine the legitimacy of the court in the eyes of Americans, in the eyes of the world. I think most Americans who go to war as part of the U.S. Armed Services, they take the oath protecting, defending the Constitution. And I think as part of that oath is also defending the ratified treaties, which are part of the law of the land. Geneva Convention is part of the law of the land. Every single person who goes to the military take that oath, and this is part of the training. You do not, in any circumstances, torture individuals, torture detainees. And that is just the golden rule. And yet, the Bush administration at the time, in the military, and then the CIA had it even worse version of it, violated all these rules that are really at the core of any training of U.S. soldiers, that you would never subject detainees and people in American U.S. custody abroad to torture and other forms of cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. And so I think that when Bolton says, what do we say to those members of the armed services, I think he owes them an apology. He owes them an explanation. Why would the United States allow such a regime of torture to take place?
We've been speaking with Jamil Dakhwar, director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program. You can find their work on this and on other issues online at aclu.org. Jamil Dakhwar, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin. Counterspin is produced every week by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can find more information about FAIR on our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.